In late 2014, the New York Police Department arrested over a dozen men at Quad Recording Studios in Manhattan on charges of conspiracy, weapons possession, and drug trafficking. One of the men arrested was named Akil Jean Pollard, better known as the rapper Bobby Shmurda. And if you ain't a hoe, get up on my tripod! The NYPD didn't do this alone. They'd received significant help from an unusual ally, a tech startup from the other side of the country by the name of Palantir. According to an internal email sent to Palantir employees shortly after the arrest, a user in the NYPD had found relations between the suspects, and other officers at headquarters were able to trace connections between shootings. The info was shared on a giant Palantir graph projected at a weekly NYPD meeting. I believe it's the first time that a Palantir-related case has been reported by TMZ. If we fast forward to today, over a decade after this brief interaction, the parties involved have ended up going in vastly different directions. Bobby was put in jail until 2021, when he was eventually released and tried to restart his rap career to very little fanfare. Palantir, on the other hand, have done a lot better for themselves since then. They've grown from a relatively unknown Silicon Valley startup into an infamous household name, and in the process, they've developed a reputation that precedes them. But despite that reputation, it's still incredibly difficult for the average person to concisely describe what Palantir actually does. Whereas other tech companies have invested billions in trying to market their products to buyers, Palantir has opted for a different strategy, and they've instead shrouded their brand in this secrecy that makes them feel more like an intelligence agency than a publicly traded stock. But they are, at the end of the day, another large publicly traded company, which means the work that they do has to be comprehensible enough for people to keep investing in them. The thing about Palantir is that once you understand their origin story, what they do, and where they're trying to go, things suddenly become a lot less opaque and mysterious, and their role in society today starts to make a lot more sense. Whenever I think about Palantir, my brain goes straight to that one meme about how tech founders always miss the point in like fantasy and sci-fi novels. At long last, we've created the Torment Nexus from the classic sci-fi novel, Don't Create the Torment Nexus. Palantir is like the prime example of this. The name comes from the Lord of the Rings series, where a Palantir is this magical seeing stone that allows you to instantly observe events happening anywhere across the world. This like global instant surveillance camera that eliminates all concept of privacy for the people of Middle-earth. It seems like the perfect thing to name your tech company after. The leadership of the company would really like the public to believe that their tools are nothing like their fantasy namesake, however. Let's listen to their CEO, Alex Karp, talking about whether any of their tools are ever used to violate people's privacy.
One of the criticisms or concerns that I hear is that Palantir has a large-scale data collection program on American citizens. Can you just clear that up?
And we are the single worst technology to use to abuse civil liberties. And until recently, like, SIGINT institutions would never buy our product. Spend 20 minutes looking at the product. 20 minutes looking at the product and say, is this not the hardest product to abuse in the world?
So he makes this argument quite frequently, to be honest. But Palantir has an origin story that is basically the complete opposite of everything their CEO says publicly. Palantir's story begins in the 1990s at the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. Around this time, in the late 90s, the CIA was having a bit of an identity crisis. The Soviet Union, which had been its main rival since it was founded, had collapsed in 1991. By the mid-1990s, the recruitment of new CIA analysts had fallen to almost zero, and the budget was cut by 18% over the decade. It was a stark change from the 60s and 70s, where the CIA was responsible for a bunch of really major tech breakthroughs. But now, this was happening all in the private sector, at places like Google, Microsoft, and Apple. And so, they decided to kind of shake things up, right? Instead of trying to compete with the innovation taking place in tech companies, they would instead just buy the companies, or at least buy enough of a stake to have a meaningful say over their direction. In 1999, the director of the CIA, George Tenet, came together with a good friend of his, the ex-CEO of Lockheed Martin, to make a major announcement. The US government would invest $30 million in seed funding to form a new company called InQtel. This would be a venture capital firm that would find growing tech startups and fund them on behalf of the CIA. Importantly, InQtel wouldn't be owned by the government, so it wouldn't have to be as transparent as the government in disclosing its investments. And so, just a few years later, in 2005, they invested several million dollars into a little-known startup named Palantir. Palantir at this point was basically brand new. They'd literally been founded just 1 year earlier by Peter Thiel and a few of his friends. They didn't have a proper product on sale, and they'd struggled to find any investors, despite Thiel being so well-connected in the business world. At this point, Palantir was really more like of a concept of a plan, you might say. It took another few years for Palantir to develop a product that they felt was good enough to sell. And naturally, they felt that the best place to promote their product was VizWeek, an annual conference that brings together academics, companies, and government agencies to talk about the latest advances in data visualization techniques. One of the attendees at this conference was GCHQ, the UK's cyber intelligence agency. They were among some of the first people on the planet to actually witness what Palantir's technology could do. I came across this leaked GCHQ report from that period, and they say, quite simply, you need to see it to believe it. So, what did Palantir show these guys that had them so shook? Well, lucky for us, the Palantir team that they sent there ended up writing a handful of papers explaining their work at VizWeek, which I think actually serve as the clearest explanation out there of why the company exists in the first place. Now, you might not be aware of this, but there's already a whole industry out there that is profiting from invading your privacy. And they exist completely out in the open. Data brokers have been harvesting and selling our personal information for years now, including things like your home address and your place of work. But it would take years to find and contact each of these brokers one by one, which is why I'm glad that this video is sponsored by Incogni. Incogni does all the hard work of getting your information off of these databases by contacting all of these brokers for you. They'll use the proper legal channels, they'll handle any subsequent objections, and they'll regularly check up on these brokers in order to minimize the odds of your data falling into the wrong hands. Instead of spending hours submitting and resubmitting removal requests, Incogni handles the process from top to bottom. On the off chance that your data ends up somewhere outside of their standard network of brokers, then you can just send them a link and their custom removals feature will get your information taken down and keep it that way. If you want less spam and more control over your privacy, then you can check out Incogni. They're offering my viewers a whopping 60% off and a 30-day money-back guarantee if you use my link, incogni.com/fats. Thanks so much to Incogni for sponsoring this video. Let's get back to it. The Palantir team had been sent to this conference to take part in a competition sponsored by intelligence agencies, in which participants were tasked with solving a series of technical challenges that centered around the Paraiso movement, this fictional anti-American terror organization. The teams taking part were given a bunch of seemingly unrelated datasets. It was things like a fictitious Wikipedia page for the Paraiso movement, including its full edit history. They were given Coast Guard immigration enforcement data covering boats that were intercepted at sea, arrests, and illegal landings on US shores. They got a document containing a bunch of phone call records. And finally, they were given RFID badge logs from a fictional terror attack, where they tracked exactly where each person's badge had been scanned as they were evacuating the building. The goal was to use this information to figure out which phone belonged to the leader of this fictional group, what the social network of the group looked like, and to get as close as possible to a full analysis of their movements, communications, and roles as member of this terrorist organization. And the Palantir team nailed it. The product that they demoed is today known as Gotham, but at the time it was simply called Palantir Government. And it seeked to achieve four things. I'll let them explain in their own words, courtesy of the paper that they wrote at this conference.
The first is data integration. Whether structured or unstructured, Palantir provides standard and extensible interfaces for bringing information into a common environment.
In the challenge, Palantir was able to load the data from the Wikipedia edits and label all of the users and their connections and the type of behavior they saw. They were then able to also load in the phone call records and the immigration data and have all of that in the Palantir platform, even if the data had initially been in completely different formats.
The second is search and discovery, whereby these disparate data stores can be explored as though they were one.
Where Palantir really shines is in letting users connect datasets to each other. You might think that like a Wikipedia page's edit history isn't necessarily that valuable on its own, but Wikipedia edits include IP addresses and timestamps, which means that if you can combine it with phone call records and flight records and other location data, then it can actually give you quite a lot of insight into a person's movement, behaviors, and beliefs over time.
The third is knowledge management, in which all the knowledge that is discovered is treated like another data source, so no analysis is lost. And finally, the fourth is collaboration, whereby many analysts working together can truly leverage their collective mind.
Palantir software lets you do even more, right? It lets you hardwire relationships into the database, so that once an analyst had connected, like, a phone number to a suspected person, any future dataset that was loaded into the Palantir system could automatically look for that phone number. And it wouldn't matter what the future dataset looked like. It could be images of police notes, or it could be a massive data dump from a social media hack. The whole idea is that all formats of data can now become linkable and searchable with relatively little technical experience from the user. When you hear Palantir executives say in press releases that they aren't collecting data on Americans, for example, they're not necessarily lying, but they are being incredibly dishonest. The real challenge isn't gathering data, because government data collection is already rampant. The real challenge is actually getting any insight from this mound of seemingly unrelated information. And Palantir themselves lay this out very clearly in one of their 2008 papers. They say the following.
Raw data is growing more abundant and inexpensive every day. Unfortunately, these new datasets are frequently extremely large and contain only a kernel of significant information. Our goal is to allow analysts to uncover relevance by asking rich, high-level questions of their data without having to know languages such as SQL.
Understanding this principle, this idea that Palantir specializes in data integration and analysis, and not necessarily data collection, suddenly helps us clarify why they have so many seemingly unrelated clients. Palantir operates by sending their own staff directly into a client's offices, and the systems they build are designed for their customers to track anything that can be tracked. It could be used to track the supply chain of an Airbus jet, which can contain like 5 million plus parts from around the world. In that case, a Palantir system could, for example, immediately flag a product shortage in Wales to a team in Germany, even if those teams use completely different underlying computer systems. And it's here that you can start to see the analogy with the Lord of the Rings Palantir more clearly. Palantir's system sits on top of all of these disconnected data sources and gives you instant visibility over the whole thing. Again, this is one of the points where I wonder how closely the founders actually read the source material, because in Lord of the Rings, the writer is pretty clear about the flaws of such a system. Even with access to all of the data on the planet, the Palantir in Lord of the Rings can selectively display truthful images in order to create a false conclusion in the viewer's mind. They can create all these false narratives by playing on the biases of the person looking into the stone. Of the person looking at the data. In the books, one of the characters is literally driven to suicide because the images he sees in this Palantir are selectively biased by a rival in order to paint a misleading picture of reality. This guy ends up literally burning himself alive and dies clutching the Palantir in his hands. It's not like a very deeply hidden metaphor, nor is it a shining endorsement of this kind of technology. And you know, maybe if this stuff was just used to make one more jumbo jet per day, or to optimize the supply chain for Wendy's Baconators, then things wouldn't be so bad. Like, I could stop talking to you right now and we would all move on with our lives. But of course, that isn't just what it's used for.
Our product is used on occasion to kill people.
On February 28th, 2026, US and Israeli forces declared war on the Islamic Republic of Iran. One of the earliest targets hit by the US was a girls' school in Menab, which resulted in the deaths of over 100 school children. By the end of the first 4 days of this war, the US and Israel had struck around 2,000 targets in total. If we compare this to the US-led campaign against ISIS in Iraq and Syria that had taken place about a decade earlier, it took them 6 months to strike 2,000 targets. This time, it took 4 days, in no small part thanks to the work of the people at Palantir. Almost 2 decades have passed since 2008, when Palantir first demoed their product to intelligence agencies. And since then, their software offerings have matured quite a lot. One of the biggest developments since then has been the creation of the Maven Smart System. Palantir's Maven Smart System, along with Anthropic's Claude AI, have become the backbone of the US military systems, and they now support the entire kill chain, which is choosing targets, choosing weaponry, organizing the strikes, and assessing the final battlefield damage as well. And it represents like the next evolution in Palantir's data integration dream. As of 2024, Maven had 179 different live data feeds plugged into this one dashboard. It's stuff like photographs and satellite imagery and all sorts of other sources. They've also now added a bunch of AI and machine learning tools, so even less human intervention is needed than ever before. Before this system existed, the kill chain involved printing documents and photographs and getting written approval from a senior officer, a process which could sometimes take days. According to insiders at the Department of Defense now, though, this Palantir software has helped to shrink this process down to minutes, and it's being used now to make about 1,000 decisions per hour on the battlefield. According to the Department of Defense, humans still do make the final call, but that is little consolation when you see the scale of civilian damage taking place right now. Palantir, at their core, is a military intelligence company. This is where they started, this is where they got their money from, and government work is still today the majority of their revenue. And while the examples I've covered so far do make it seem like it's mostly used abroad and it's mostly used in counterterrorism, however you define that, it's worth remembering that any weapon or any tool that can be used against enemies abroad can also be used against the enemy within.
We have two enemies. We have the outside enemy, and then we have the enemy from within. And the enemy from within, in my opinion, is more dangerous than China, Russia, and all these countries.
You've probably noticed by now that I don't usually have that many compliments to offer the US government. You know, the global reputation of the US is not exactly at a high point right now. But I do want to be fair, because there are some things that do make the USA unique, in theory at least, right? One of those things is the US Constitution. Since about 1803, they've had this concept in place called judicial review, which means that no sitting government can pass a law or act in a way that violates the basic guarantees of the US Constitution. This is not like anywhere near a universal system, even in other like liberal democracies. In the UK, we don't have a single written constitution, and thus we don't necessarily have the same kind of guarantees that a US citizen might have. And when it comes down to what those rights actually are, I think one of the best ones is the Fourth Amendment of the US Constitution.
The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized.
In plain English, this just means that the government can't search you, they can't search your home or your stuff without a good legal reason. If the police wants to search or seize something from you, they almost always need a warrant from a judge. The whole point of this is to guarantee this reasonable expectation of privacy. This idea that the government shouldn't know that much about your life unless they've got a really good reason to. As I say, this is all in theory. Because this amendment was ratified in 1791, right? A time when the fastest means of communication was like a smoke signal, and the people who created this amendment could not have predicted 1/10 of the technology that we'd have on hand today. Honestly, if you just sit and think about the amendment as I've described it here, for like 5 or 10 minutes, you could probably come up with some loopholes to the Fourth Amendment. Clearly, the police can't search your home without a warrant or take your phone without a warrant, but what if they parked across the road from you and point a thermal imaging camera at your door? Or what if the feds attach a GPS tracker to the outside of your car? Would that count as an illegal search? It depends on who you ask, and there is disagreement on this going all the way up to the Supreme Court. Some judges, like Justice Samuel Alito, have argued that only long-term GPS monitoring would violate your Fourth Amendment right to privacy. Others, like Sonia Sotomayor, go even further and argue that even short-term GPS monitoring should be considered a violation of the Fourth Amendment. The point I'm making is that the Constitution is not this like ironclad, unambiguous document, and every government since the 1800s has tried to find ways around it, and the existence of Palantir has made that job so much easier than ever before. Governments across the world infamously have lots of old, obsolete computer systems designed to operate without integration in mind. If you've ever had to interact with two government departments, you've likely experienced this firsthand. Sometimes this is to the benefit of citizens, however. For example, the IRS, the US tax authority, specifically asks you to include the proceeds of crime on your tax returns. The whole point of this is not so that they can just like arrest you for self-snitching, but it's rather because the job of the IRS is to collect as much tax revenue as possible, regardless of where it's coming from. The Nixon administration in the 70s famously began using tax audits as a political weapon against their rivals, and they would tie them up in these years-long investigations and give the IRS a bunch of work that they should never have had. After the Nixon administration, laws were passed to keep tax data private and independent from other agencies, so that the tax guys could focus on tax-related affairs, and they would only rope in the rest of the government if they genuinely needed the help. And so, when the news came out that the US government, Doge, and Palantir were working on a single searchable database of all tax data that could be shared with other government agencies, a number of people were rightfully concerned. The idea that a single bit of government software could potentially combine tax records with medical data, with police reports and social security, and driving data, and your phone's location, and literally anything else the government has on you, is terrifying. Because all of this information, if it can be combined properly, can paint a way clearer picture of a person's behaviors and movements than breaking into their home without a warrant or sticking a GPS receiver on their car. The Fourth Amendment effectively became obsolete when we invented all of this technology and didn't update the laws to account for the existence of this technology. And thus, all that has happened, thanks to Palantir, is that citizens have begun to lose fundamental rights. Rights that no government is supposed to have the power to violate. The real danger of Palantir isn't that they're violating people's privacy by expanding the scale of data collection, but instead they're working out ways to make the most of information that already exists in databases today, since that info is likely already sufficient for most of the spying that they'd want to do. And for them, the benefit is clear. Like, after all, they are mainly in this game to make money. And one of the reasons why Palantir has been able to grow so quickly comes down to the fact that they end up just acting as like a subscription service for governments. The NYPD realized this firsthand a few years after the whole Bobby Shmurda saga, when they tried to cancel their Palantir contract because they wanted to move to an in-house system instead. Palantir refused to provide any analysis that had been done in their software in a format that could be easily exported into a different software. And so Palantir becomes more and more important, more and more entrenched in all of these governments, and able to charge higher and higher maintenance and support fees. And the only losers end up being us, basically, who either lose our rights or end up dead solely in the name of more profit for Palantir.